Hello everyone, welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, liberalism, and peace. This is Omar Sadr, a senior research scholar at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Governance and Markets. My guest in this episode is Dr. Nader Hashimi, who is the director of Al-Waid Center for Muslim Christian Understanding and associate professor of Middle East Studies and Islamic Politics at the Welsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. In this conversation, we discuss his book, Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Toward a Democratic Theory of Muslim Societies, which was published in 2012. Among many other things, he spoke about the idea behind this book, the need for religious reformation in Muslim societies, the reasons behind the failure of reformist movement or Islahat in Iran, and finally, the various meanings of secularism in Muslim societies. I'm sure you will enjoy listening to him in this podcast. On to the show. Okay, good afternoon, Nader, and welcome to Negotiating Ideas. I'm so glad to have you here.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
All right. So this talk, I'm interested to speak with you about your book, which has been almost 15 years, Islam, Secularism, and Liberalism, and you try to develop a liberal democratic theory for Muslim societies. It is an old book, but I think it has much to tell us about contemporary Muslim and Middle Eastern societies, given the dynamics between Islamism and democratic movements in the region, particularly in my country and your country, in Afghanistan and Iran. So why don't we start with you briefing us about why did you write the book, first of all, and then what are the main theses?
Yeah, so the book that you reference, Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Toward a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, was an updated version of my doctoral dissertation that I wrote at the University of Toronto, which I defended in 2005. And so the book came out a few years later. And the reason why I wrote the book and the reason why I pursued that particular topic as a subject of research and as the focus of my doctoral dissertation is that I was always interested in, you know, the relationship between religion and democracy as two sort of categories that always had deep tension and friction. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, I was born and raised in Canada. I did most of my education there, and being raised in a secular political context, the reigning orthodoxy, the received wisdom on the relationship between religion and democracy was that the two don't go together. Mm. That the less religion you have, the better it is for democracy. Democracy simply cannot accommodate religious ideas and religious views, particularly if you're talking about a liberal democracy, because a liberal democracy presupposes a certain set of norms of equality that clash with the religious belief systems and the identity claims that religious groups make that tend to be exclusive to members of that religion. And so, of course, the backdrop of this was my own sort of personal upbringing. There's a great line by one of my mentors, Alfred Stepan, who I talk about in the book at Columbia University. He passed away a few years ago. But he said, we often pursue research topics because the existing mainstream literature that we read sits uncomfortably within our minds, knowing that we have, you know, personal experiences and ideas that clash with the mainstream narrative and assumptions that inform a particular topic. And that resonated with me because that's exactly what I believed and how I felt when I would read the mainstream discussion and literature on religion and democracy and the challenges facing democracy in Muslim majority societies. I didn't like what I was reading. I thought a lot of it was deeply ideological, did not understand what was happening at the grassroots level within Muslim societies, particularly the potential for certain expressions and interpretations of religion, politicized religions, to make contributions to democracy. Mm. That whole idea was something that I could clearly see, but it was a dissident idea. And when I talked about it in class and with my supervisor, they were somewhat perplexed. And so that's really what I wanted to sort of, research and write about. Of course, the other related concept here is the question of secularism.
That's right.
Okay. You know, when I grew up in Canada, secularism was broadly associated with a set of positive attributes. Secularism implied progress, toleration. It was deeply connected to the development of democracy. You know, the more secularism, the better. And the problem with that was that it clashed with my own understanding of how secularism manifested itself in Muslim majority societies. And so I was really caught between these two worlds where you heard nice things about secularism in the West, but secularism in terms of the modern Middle East and modern Muslim experience was, in my reading, associated with a lot of negative attributes. Secularism was associated with these post-colonial modernizing regimes in the Middle East that claimed to be progressive, forward-looking, modern, but at the same time, they were deeply authoritarian. And of course, the quintessential example of this is Turkey under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, which was widely praised, actually, in Western circles because, you know, he, I think really for actually, you know, prejudicial reasons that, you know, there's been a longstanding view in the West that Muslim societies are unable to develop and progress precisely because they are Muslim societies, that there's something toxic or problematic within Islamic political thought that prevents them from undergoing a process of development and accommodating democratic norms. And the reason why Atatürk got such good press in the West is there was this view that he understood that fact, allegedly. And when he radically secularized Turkey, and when he dismantled the Ottoman Empire, and when he sought to emulate European standards of lifestyle and norms, he was praised for that because he was reinforcing, I think, widely held beliefs in the West that, you know, Islam could not contribute, or Muslim political thought could not contribute to modernization, progress, and democracy. But of course, you know, Atatürk had a dark side. He was a modernizing ruler. He was very secular. He was very Western oriented, but he was also deeply authoritarian. And one of the things that I was noticing in the late 20th century, getting into the 21st century, that was that within Turkey, some of the most, I think, democratic minded voices at that time who were supporting democracy and human rights and political pluralism were not the establishment secular parties in Turkey. They were one, they were parties that were coming out of a religious orientation, particularly the the AK Party, the Justice and Development Party, led by Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And if you look back on that period, at least for the first decade of Erdogan's rule, I think Turkey was experiencing greater levels of democracy and development. Of course, that came to a crashing end roughly around 2011, 2012, 2013, and it's gone in the opposite direction. But at least one could, you know, if one focuses on that decade, roughly 2002, 2003, until about 10 years later, one does notice significant expansion of democracy and of liberalism within Turkey. And then that trend was also happening in other parts of the Islamic world. So I wanted to write about that whole topic. So I look at sort of three case studies. The methodology is it's a study of, you know, comparative political theory. It's an examination of the historical origins of the emergence of democracy and its relationship to secularism. And that's where I think I make a theoretical contribution. It's not really my contribution. It's really a contribution that I completely am indebted to because of the work of Alfred Stepan, who in his famous essay or book chapter called The World Religions and the Twin Tolerations provides, I think, the best theoretical grasp of the relationship between religion and democracy and the question of secularism. And he's basically redefines the question of secularism by producing this term called the twin tolerations. He basically contracts the definition. He still calls for the necessity of some form of separation between the forces of religion, the institutions of religion, and the state. But he makes an argument that the widely held assumption that there needed to be a robust sort of wall of separation, and that these two things, religion and democracy, could not be coexisting or compatible, is empirically false, and it also completely ignores the, a particular history of the development of democracy in the West. And I thought, you know, by focusing on that angle and that theoretical contribution, there was lessons to be learned for the contemporary Muslim world. So that was the book in a nutshell. And of course, the paradox that I, or the puzzle that I seek to sort of unravel in the book is that the mainstream understanding of political thought, political science, suggests that democracy requires a form of secularism to sustain itself. That's sort of a broad view that was never really examined or questioned. But then in the context of the contemporary Islamic world, some of the most active organized political groups and thinkers that were advocating for democracy were religious groups, were drawing upon a religious perspective. So there was a tension there that needed to be raveled, the tension being, just in a nutshell, that modern democracy, liberal democracy, required a form of secularism, yet people advocating for democracy in Muslim-majority societies were drawing upon religious-inspired, theologically-inspired political ideas to advocate for democracy. So how do those two things get go together? And I think they go together basically in the way that Alfred Stepan has outlined in his famous thesis that I just discussed. So it was really an attempt to sort of theoretically and historically look at the development of democracy in the West, focusing on the question of religion, and to see, you know, what the similarities and differences are in terms of that project and that development in the contemporary Islamic world. And so one of the figures that I examine in the book quite with close scrutiny is John Locke. Because John Locke, in my view, is the one of the, I mean, there's many, but he's one of the founding fathers of liberal democracy. Mm-hmm. And of course, people don't realize that John Locke was a very religious man who was sort of, as I say in the book, he had one foot in tradition, one foot in modernity, and was sort of dealing with these questions of religion and politics. And, you know, in his famous A Letter Concerning Toleration, sort of lays out an argument on how religion and democracy and religious pluralism could coexist. And I thought there were insights there, there were parallels there that I saw in terms of what John Locke was struggling to do and what contemporary Islamic reformers were trying to do in the context of the contemporary Muslim world. So that was the book. I was lucky that the book sort of emerged. Sometimes you get lucky with timing. Of course, you know, my dissertation and then the book took place after 9/11 in the context of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, when much of the Western foreign policy and intellectual debate were focusing on this important transformative moment in world affairs, where the question of democracy development was very much on the agenda, and there was a lot of interest in trying to figure out, you know, what that actually meant and how it would manifest itself. So I think that helped me in the job market, because there was more demands for courses and teaching and scholarship on that area, in that broad area. And so that helped me get a job at the University of Denver eventually, which I the institution that I taught at for the last 15 years, and I had a very wonderful experience there, broadly speaking, except for the last year. But you don't need to know about the last year, because that's off topic.
Thanks for that very elaborative brief of the book. And let me pick from the point that you mentioned two things. One, the example of Turkey, the other one, Alfred Stepan. And I think one of the key dilemmas that the STEL scholars try to engage with is the fact that in Muslim world broadly, those groups, movements, and political parties which advocate for democracy, as you said, they are coming from a religiously enriched background. And that is there's the dilemma. Even some scholars, recently Shadi Hamid wrote the book, The Problem of Democracy, where he says, well, let's decouple political and cultural liberalism, because these societies may culturally may not get aligned at all with liberalism, but why to deny democracy for these societies? So let these societies be democratic, and even if that outcome of democracy will enable these parties which come into the power. And as you said, in example of Turkey, at least since 2013, we see an authoritarian reverse. So even if a successful case of democracy, and which is Turkey, has a reverse, not fully now authoritarian, of course, and some sort of electoral democracy, but what does it tell us? Why even in Turkey, you give an example of a Bent declaration, which is signed by a number of religious scholars, including Gulen movement. Gulen movement has been suppressed. How can we still lay hope in your thesis if the model itself is problematic now and other scholars come and contest it? Let's abandon liberalism and just stick with democracy.
Well, I don't think the model is flawed. I think the lesson of Turkey and its democratic opening and then contraction, you know, under the same political party and leadership, is nothing really unique to Turkey or unique to Islam. I think we have to remember that if you study the history of democracy, it's always an ongoing battle and struggle where democracies that you sometimes think are moving in the right direction, well, then all of a sudden, you know, face a crisis for reasons that we can discuss and move in the opposite direction. And so, you know, the parallel that I would point to, it's actually a more interesting example, is what's happening in the United States today.
Yeah.
You know, the United States was widely viewed as, you know, the leading democracy in the world, a consolidated democracy in the world. It's an open question whether it is a democracy right now. And then how do we explain the rise of Trump and populism and the reverse of sort of the democratic trend? You know, so democracies, you know, experience political, social, economic, international crises, and they reverse and they go in the opposite direction. We're seeing these trends in other long consolidated liberal democracies in Europe, where there are rising populist movements that have very illiberal agendas. Turkey was not a democracy, and I don't think it still is a full democracy in the broad sense of the term, electoral democracy, perhaps. So these types of, you know, I think each country has to be analyzed on its own terms, in terms of its own historical, political, geographic context to figure out, you know, what went wrong and why democracy, which seemed at one point very prosperous, has now sort of stopped and is moving in the other direction. So I think that's the point here is that democracy is always it's an ongoing struggle, has to be defended. It meets challenges and obstacles along the way. And, you know, defenders of democracy have to make strong arguments and have to fight for democracy. It doesn't sort of continue by itself. And it's often met with, you know, challenges, people who want to change the democracy or reinterpret it in ways that are undemocratic or authoritarian. This is part of the whole history of democracy that I think is not sufficiently appreciated. And so the other parallel in terms of the contemporary Islamic world was the one successful case of democracy that emerged after the Arab Spring, and that's Tunisia. Tunisia was getting very good marks in terms of democratic development. Everyone thought that democracy was consolidated there, that it was moving in the right direction, but then all of a sudden in 2021, it collapsed. And authoritarianism returned, and now the president, the current dictator, Qais Saied, is firmly entrenched in power, and it doesn't look like he's going anywhere. So we have to analyze what went wrong. You know, why did democracy in Tunisia, which seemed to be moving in the right direction, suddenly collapse and reverse itself? These are themes that are not unique to the Muslim world. They're not unique to, I mean, they're broadly themes that are very much part of the whole history and nature of democracy, that there's always ups and downs, there's always setbacks. And even when you have a consolidated democracy, you know, things can go in the opposite direction.
That's right. And I think, let me just give one more example from just in the scholarship, and then we can move from this debate to the next stage probably, is a recent book by Timur Kuran, which is Freedom Delayed. And his thesis is that Muslim society in general, they don't have a problem out of over 50 plus countries of Islamic organization, OIC. Only Middle Eastern societies have a problem with liberalism and democracy. So he questions what is wrong with this particular region, not, for example, South Asia or Southeast Asia or even North Africa. And the example that he gives, for example, I think he agrees at some point with you, but also he departs from you. And the fact that in most of these Middle Eastern societies, political culture has been reinforced by some foreign power, United States, for example. But he denies that fact and says that some certain Islamic institutions, which are coming from long back history, even before Mongol invasion or European colonialism, has been the main factor of this kind of urge for authoritarianism. And I think one, so several factors that he emphasizes, economics, but one which is related to political theory is, of course, the idea of lack of toleration and certain form of kind of heretic kind of suppression. Those who are accused of heresy in Muslim societies, that is one of the key issues that he points finger on. And he relates that with lack of a strong civil society to check state power, the, mm-hmm. the ruler's power. Mm-hmm. And that, according to him, this comes from the political experience of Muslim society itself. It doesn't have anything to do with other factors. How do you counter that argument in that case?
Well, I'm uncomfortable with arguments that try and locate the contemporary problem of authoritarianism into the early origins of Islam as if there's, you know, a continuity and nothing has changed. I think things radically changed in the Islamic world in the modern period with the emergence of modern states, first colonial states and post-colonial states, where power was basically concentrated in the hands of a ruling elite, often the military, that controlled everything. And increasingly, yeah. as we went to the end of the 20th century, they became, you know, Praetorian, draconian, you know, one-person states, family dictatorships, military dictatorships that controlled everything, including the interpretation of religion, how religion was taught. I mean, this happened also under Ataturk too, when religion was consolidated. They had a ministry that sort of, you know, would actually write the Friday sermons, the khutbas for the imams, and tell them what they could say and not say. And that happens, you know, in every, I think, Muslim country today, in the Middle East in particular, including Iran. And so the problem here is really, in my reading, state centralization of power, the absence of checks and balances, the absence of political transparency to hold power accountable, that explains, I think, the authoritarian nature of these societies. I think if there was a more public accountability of, you know, ruling regimes toward their societies, if there was a strong legal system, if there was an ability for people to start, you know, testing the boundaries of what constitutes heresy and what doesn't. I mean, you know, Muslim societies are no different here than the West. I mean, the West was not always as tolerant and pluralistic and accepting of, you know, political heresy and dissident points of view. You would get persecuted. I mean, the one case, for example, that is known to me was that in roughly 1941, the leading intellectual in the world at the time, liberal intellectual, was Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was in the United States, and he was teaching at a university in New York, a state university, and he was basically fired from his job because he was considered by New Yorkers at the time to be teaching things that were so heretical, so sort of unacceptable to American society. And this wasn't ancient history. This was like in the 1940s. And he lost his job over that particular issue. Mm-hmm. So all societies have these sort of red lines. Societies don't all of a sudden emerge being sort of, you know, completely tolerant, completely open. These are battles and these are changes in political culture that are deeply connected to the evolution and transformation of societies over a period of time. And they have to do with education levels. They have to do with, I think, the socioeconomic underpinnings of a society in terms of how affluent and stable those socioeconomic underpinnings are. They have to do with, you know, changing interpretations of religion. None of that type of political experimentation has been able to take place in the modern Middle East because authoritarianism has dominated the landscape from inception, from before independence and after independence. So, you know, you can take any country, take Egypt, for example. You know, Egypt was, you know, occupied by the British in 1882, They basically dominated that state until right up until World War II. Even afterwards, there was a brief interim period where the pro-British monarchy was in charge. People were struggling for independence. And then Gamal Abdel Nasser stages a political, you know, coup, establishes a republic, and then he becomes, and the military becomes the dominant force. And the military tells the religious institutions what they can say, what they can't say. And that basically process continues, you know, right up until today. Other factors are in play, of course. You know, I think so. American support helps perpetuate authoritarianism in the Middle East. And so, yes, you know, there are, I think, problems within, you know, Islamic tradition. There are, you know, I mean, one of the big issues that keeps coming up is the whole question of blasphemy laws.
Yes.
You know, are there red lines that constitute sort of speech and behavior and discussion that are so offensive to a particular community that they're considered to be out of bounds for acceptable debate and discussion? And this sort of riles people up and it gets them upset. And of course, Western liberals then sort of look at the Islamic world and say very prejudicial things that are very ignorant historically. You know, why can't Muslims sort of, you know, read good novels like the Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie and enjoy them like we in the West can, ignoring their own history and battles over these particular issues that, you know, rocked and shaped and were also deeply divisive. So I don't think that Muslim societies are any different here. I think if they were to have functioning democracies, independent judiciaries, an economic social underpinning that produced stability, at least for the majority of people, that they would eventually, Muslims would grapple with the same type of tensions and controversies and, you know, ideas that all emerging political communities going through a modernization process have to struggle with. For example, I mean, the status of women in society, right? I mean, mm-hmm. the West likes to claim that they were always in favor of, you know, equal rights and of, you know, women always had a sacred position. And but if you know anything about the history of women's rights in the West, you know that roughly 100 years ago, yeah. Many women in the West did not have the right to vote. And even when that right to vote was granted, it was granted to only
even
women.
Even some countries like Switzerland in the 1970s.
Yeah. So what happened? You know, it was a struggle. It was a contestation. It was a, and if you look actually at the arguments that were invoked in the 19th, I mean, even going back 18th century, 19th century into the 20th century that opposed equal rights for women, there are arguments that are actually very similar to debates that we hear in conservative religious circles in the Islamic world today, that the nature mm-hmm. of women doesn't allow them to hold certain positions, that hey, women can't be judges, women can't be leaders because there's something about their essential makeup. Identical mm-hmm. arguments that that existed in the West, but they it changed not because the West had some essential, enduring, you know, characteristic about it that made it pro equal rights for women. These things yeah. change because of political struggle, because of contestation, because of debate, because of sacrifice, because of, you know, educational, you know, transformations that took place among mm-hmm. men and women that eventually allowed a particular moment to crystallize and then take deep root in a particular culture. And then things moved in a particular direction and, you know, things became different for at least half of society. You know, one can see similar things happening in Muslim majority societies today. Of course, the difference is we don't have, like the West had, a strong social economic safety net, but also a stable democracy that would continue to, you know, produce and allow civil society to emerge. And so getting back to civil society, you know, you mm-hmm. can't have a civil society unless you have a civil state. What I mean by that is that civil society can only function as sort of these autonomous organizations that emerge from society above the level of the family, but below the level of the state. And they're allowed to organize themselves and pursue issues that are of interest to their members. You're only allowed to have a functioning civil society if you have a state that is willing to recognize its own limitations in terms of how far it can go legally and interfering in the activities of civil society. Mm-hmm. The state has to be civil in the sense that the state also has to, you know, observe the law and allow for freedom of civil society groups to operate. What we don't have in the contemporary Middle East and Arab world in particular is civil states that are willing to recognize autonomy for societal groups, It's the job of these authoritarian states to control society. They're fearful of society. They crush any sort of independent expression because they suffer from a crisis of legitimacy. They're fearing, you know, they want to perpetuate their own rule. And so you have, in fact, the opposite of a civil state. You have very, you know, uncivil, draconian states that have actually gone much more repressive and draconian with every passing decade, with some interruptions in between. But I think one of the consequences of the Arab Spring, for example, and I include Iran in this equation, is that the Arab Spring political context is much more repressive, much more, you know, draconian, much more suffocating for civil society today, post 2011, than it was before then. I mean, just take the case of Egypt. People now look back on the authoritarian rule of Hosni Mubarak, and they sort of view that as a somewhat of a much more peaceful and open atmosphere compared to, you know, what's happening today under General el-Sisi. And that applies to Iran, applies to Saudi Arabia, applies to many countries around the world. But you still see, you know, these societal disruptions taking place in Iran, for example, over women's rights, over workers' rights, over environmental concerns. You know, just prior to COVID in 2019, there were major societal protests in several major, countries in the Middle East and North Africa. Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Algeria had mass protests, you know, people demanding accountability and political change. So I'm very skeptical. I haven't read Timur Kuran's book. I do respect his work, but I'm very skeptical of these arguments that seem to suggest that there's a certain fossilized, enduring, essential nature in Muslim societies that can be traced back to the pre-modern period. And that's why there's been an absence of liberal democratic development. Mm-hmm. All societies have traditions. All societies have a particular set of values. But I don't think those values are fossilized and they don't change. They change very much. I mean, you know, you can just see it in my own lifetime. The attitudes that I think exist now, for example, among people in the Middle East with respect to women's education, women's role in the public sphere. It's very different today than it was, for example, during my grandparents' time in terms of, you know, the options that existed for women and what was acceptable and what. That's a major transformation, even given the fact that, you know, you haven't had the type of democratic opening and consistent democratic development that we would like to see. But I think there's been a radical sea change on those issues. And so that's how I view it.
I want to come to that point about a civil state that you made in the Middle East, and most of these states are really oppressive, policing kind of state there. Those institutions of the state which are controlling society are much more regressive and effective compared to those institutions that provide services. And that one of that cases, of course, Iran. Under a religious institution and regime, people of Iran has really transformed to become quite secular. The number of women participation in higher education is quite higher than men in many other Muslim societies. And as you discuss in your book also, like many other Muslim progressive societies, Indonesia and East Asia or Tunisia, for example, the case that you bring, there was also an attempt in Iran to generate a kind of a secularist theory or reformation of Islam. At least one of the exiled scholars who's now living here in the United States is Suroosh. Very, very popular theories. But the point is that you have that prerequisite that you suggest, which is religious reformation or the ideas to reform religion. We also have transformation of societies, a strong civil society, awareness of women, high participation in workforce, high participation in education. But the problem remains with a very repressive state. And in case, for example, in another case like Afghanistan, even if the state is not repressive, it's a weak state in terms of its efficiency, but it's still, it's very brutal to suppress women, deny them, and create a kind of gender apartheid. So how can we transform this situation? We have the theory that you require. You have the civil society and aware people, women who are aware of their rights, and they are out there to protest. But we have the problem with the state. Now, how can we unlock this problem?
Yeah, I agree. The problem is the state. The problem is you have these ruling elites who capture the state, control the state, and are unwilling to, you know, share power or relinquish power. So in the case of Iran, what's interesting is you have, you know, the state still maintaining and upholding a particular ideological narrative and enforcing a set of laws on a society now that has in many ways moved beyond the ideological narrative of the state. And this creates a crisis of legitimacy. So the state, for example, in Iran wants women to dress and behave in a particular way. Most women in Iran, particularly the educated segments of society, completely reject that. And so that's, I think, in many ways what produced the women's life freedom movement in 2022 after the death of Mahsa Amini. And these you know, protests were very much, I think, a reflection of the crisis of legitimacy that the regime was facing, particularly in the eyes of women, educated women and young women.
Yeah.
But the problem still remains is that, you know, it's a problem of political power. So the state has political power and it represses society, and it can do so with increasingly greater efficiency today because it has resources, it has security services that are willing to do the repressive bidding of the state. And then you have a society down below that just takes the blows and tries to survive, waiting for another opportunity. In many ways, you know, you mentioned this before, but it's worth reiterating, is that I think the battle for ideas in Iran, as I understand it, is in many ways over. And what I mean by that is that the battle for an Iran that accommodates the basic rights of its citizens, particularly the rights of women, the desire for a clear and strong separation between religion and state, the desire for a democratic and accountable political system, is now an idea that I think has majority support. It can't articulate itself because it's an authoritarian regime. But those debates, which go back to, in many ways, the debates of the 1990s that Sarush and other reformist intellectuals were responsible for offering those ideas and debating those ideas and defending them, those ideas now, in many ways, they've sunk such deep roots that they're old ideas. Like, no one in Iran reads Sarush anymore or reads Mohsen Khedivar, because those were very much debates of the 1990s and the 2000s. I think in many ways, what's interesting is you see in Iran today, many of the most people who are deeply religious, many people who are supporters of the revolution, who are strong defenders of, you know, the ruling regime, participated and elevated the figure of Ayatollah Khomeini and all of his disciples. Now those people have in many ways become so disillusioned that they've given up on, you know, religious politics, and they've undergone their own secularization process, and they've sort of become so disillusioned by this model that has been forced upon them. In fact, it's gotten to such an extreme level where Iranians today basically have zero interest in religion. Many of them don't even know it's Ramadan. They don't care. They're hostile to any expressions of religion in ways that are completely understandable, given their 45-year experience of living under religious authoritarianism.
The reformists lost their legitimacy because what they proposed did not happen.
Yeah.
So people no more vote even for the reformists.
Yeah.
And somehow, as you said, abandon completely the religious kind of legitimate theory of democracy, even if you haven't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, on that whole issue of what, I mean, yes, the reformists, I mean, I think the reformist period in Iran is now over. Mm-hmm. People have now gone beyond that. Mm-hmm. We can debate to what extent the reformists are to blame for their failures, mm-hmm. or to what extent the problem is really to be laid at the doorstep of the repressive apparatus of the ruling regime that crushed the reformists every time they tried to manifest themselves. They didn't allow reformist presidents to work independently. There was assassinations, there was arrests, there was a complete crackdown. And, you know, the question is, and then again in 2009, you had a reformist resurgence under the, you know, the attempted presidency of Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi. But then, you know, they were then arrested and crushed and repressed. And so I mean, I understand there's a lot of frustration among Iranians blaming the reformists for failure. I think a lot of that is misguided. I think one has to put the blame where in the hands of those people who had power and repressed alternative political options. I think it's very difficult when you're living in an authoritarian state. I mean, we all have to make decisions, right? Whether the reformists could have made other decisions. What you hear right now among Iranians who are critical of the reformists is that they lied to us. They weren't sincere. They didn't do anything. In many ways, that echoes the discourse of Iranian monarchists and members of the MEK, who are, I think, in many ways, trying to rewrite history here. I think had, for example, in 2009, Mirhosin Mousavi been allowed to assume the presidency and had an independent parliament been allowed to function free of intervention from the Guardian Council, the Office of the Supreme Leader, and the IRGC, then I think, you know, there would have been, you know, policy changes, and there would have been, I think, movement and transformation in Iran. But every time there was an attempt to implement any reformist policy, it was immediately squashed, crushed, and people were arrested. And one can make the argument that the very nature of the political system prevented, you know, independent voices and democratic voices from coming to power and pursuing policies that were a reflection of the political platform that they campaigned on. Because if you read the constitution in Iran, it's actually very clear. And in this sense, you know, the ruling regime can make an argument. It's very clear that sovereignty in Iran, first and foremost, belongs to the establishment clerics. And popular sovereignty is always conditional and takes a back seat to the preferences of the ruling clerical regime. And so that's how I interpret the failure of the reform movement. I think the reform movement was successful psychologically and ideationally in terms of forcing people to think differently. But obviously it wasn't successful politically because it was never able to come to power and stay in power and pursue policies that they aspired to because of the nature of the political system in Iran that always allowed legally and extra legally the religious establishment in Iran backed by the IRGC, you know, to crush any manifestation of reform that that was emerging. But the ideas themselves, I think, you know, in many ways did inspire a lot of people. And the frustration that I see among Iranians right now is really a frustration over the general state of, you know, of politics, of political life. There's just a deep disillusionment and there's no hope because we have a deeply entrenched, you know, repressive regime that's willing to, you know, kill hundreds of people, thousands of people. 500 people were killed in the, you know, Women Life Freedom protest. In 2019, in November, you know, reports are between 500 to over 1,000 people were killed in those protests. In 2018, there was another, you know, uprising in smaller towns and villages. Several hundred people were. So this is a state that's willing to use a lot of brutality to stay in power. And that has consequences over the opportunities of opposition groups, whether they're, you know, moderate opposition groups or even, you know, opposition groups that want systemic change, whether they're, you know, just how much political space do they have? They, you know, so we have, you know, Iranian prisons are filled with dissidents. Most people have fled. And so the problem is very much the problem of political power. But that problem of political power, again, is not unique to Iran or the Middle East, to Islam. We have a lot of, you know, political systems in other parts of the world that are, you know, very repressive. And that's a function of power calculations. It's not really a reflection of the essential nature of a religious community that produces these things. It's a function of the pursuit of political power.
And that brings to my mind the example of Afghanistan, where, of course, the reform movement has not been as articulate and strong in terms of producing ideas and theories like Iran. The case of Afghanistan has been quite weak. But last 20 years, which was democracy imposed by the US intervention, was also accompanied by a local alliance. And those local alliance were those Islamist movements which fought in the 90s, but later on they really transformed and adopted democracy. One of the popular figures that I can name is Professor Burhanuddin Rabbani, which was ex-president, leading Jamiat Islami Afghanistan, and he was a cleric. He was an Islamic scholar, but he, in the last 20 years, he continuously tried in different speeches that he gave, tried to substantiate democracy and justify it based on Islamic teachings and verses of Quran and Hadith. But still, I think, in a battle between such kind of moderate Islamists and the very, very radical Taliban, we see how the radicals win. And of course, I think the answer remains what you say. It's the dynamics of the power. Now, here, given the time is very less, I want to come to the last question, and I ask you, and that you present an archaeology of the term secularism when it comes to Middle Eastern languages, Farsi and Arabic, at least. We use it, for example, in Tajikistan, it's called Dinyavi. In Afghanistan, it's called Urfi, or so many other terms. You open up this debate and say that how it is inconclusive. But at the end, I think you do not suggest a solution. I'm asking this question because I have so many friends in Afghanistan who are secular, coming from a religiously teaching family or that kind of background. When you ask them, okay, let's talk about this idea. Why don't you defend the idea to tell me privately in this conversation? Let's write it and articulate it, or probably talk about it. They are so scared because they are cautious of the repercussions that it will create. And you have given examples of Kurdish politicians in Iraq, the president who has not been using the same term, Indonesians who are secular, but they don't. So finally, how can we resolve this debate about one single term which has become complicated?
Yeah. The term secular in Muslim-majority societies for most people, not all of them, because there are constituencies of Muslims that are very happy to identify themselves as secularists. Like, for example, the supporters of the tradition of Mustafa Kemal in Turkey, who vote for the Republican Party, the CHP, they're proud to identify and use the term secular in a particular way that makes sense in the Turkish context. But I think for most people generally in the Islamic world, the term secular is deeply associated with themes of atheism, Westernization, sort of. It implies, when you use it at a general level, something that's alien, that has no moral content to it, that seeks to undermine the religious and moral foundations of society. Mm-hmm. And so when you use it in a contemporary Muslim context, it tends to sort of produce a negative reaction because those are the associations that people have with the term. Now, of course, there's, different communities, like right now in Iran, because of the experience of 45 years of religious authoritarianism, I think many people, unlike 45 years ago, are very happy to use the term separation of religion and state or secular, because they view that as a way of fighting back against the clerical authoritarian rule. In terms of how do you resolve this, my view is that it's best to not invoke the term secular because it has so many different meanings. It's not clear exactly what people are talking about. I say in the book, and I've said in some of my other writings, there's three sort of different interpretations of secularism that often get mixed into one when you use it in the context of a political discussion. Are you referring to philosophical secularism, which implies a certain form of agnosticism or atheism, or are you implying some form of sociological secularism that just means or speaks to how people live their lives, whether they spend their time in religious institutions or not, whether they, get married in the same traditional way, do they sort of inhabit and participate in terms of their daily lives in activities that have a certain religious or irreligious, in this case, more secular, orientation. And then lastly, there is the political form of secularism, which basically is concerned about the relationship between the state and society. And it's really a question of the constitutional nature of a political system. So people in society can be as religious or irreligious as they want, but political secularism really is talking about the relationship between state institutions and the legal code.
Right.
So I think it's best for Muslim societies. I mean, there's actually there's actually a lot of interesting history here that I discovered when I was reading about this. So one of the first interesting cases of secularism that actually speaks to your point was in Indonesia, when the Indonesian Muslim students, led by this brilliant man, who unfortunately I never had a chance to meet while he was still alive, Nur Khalis Majid, in early 1970s introduces a debate in Indonesia among Muslim students over this question of secularism, what it means, how can we sort of reimagine it, rethink it. And he had very good intentions, and he knew what he was talking about. But he said the societal reaction among Muslim students at that time in Indonesia was so hostile, the debate became so heated for the reasons that you're alluding to, that he ended up regretting giving that speech because it produced such negative connotations. People didn't know what he was talking about, but they thought that he was sort of trying to suggest that Indonesia should mimic the West in terms of its moral code, should sort of completely abandon its Islamic heritage. So these debates are just, I think among intellectuals and in universities and in academic seminars, I think these are the places to have these types of debates among Muslims, because you can do it in a sort of, but I think on a general level, in a mosque or in a community, they tend to be conversation stoppers. I think what's most important to think about is not the term secularism, but talk about the values, the positive values that flow from secularism in the context of a just society. Right. So the idea of equality. So secularism in the context of liberal democracy in the West implies equality of citizens, regardless of their background, ethnic, religious, socioeconomic background. Now, those are one of the values in the best sense of secularism that really emerge from the politics of secularism. So I think Muslims should be talking about what does citizenship entail, and what do we mean by, citizenship, equal citizenship for everyone? How can we get there? Mm. Those are terms that I think Muslims can relate to, or terms like social justice, or terms like the need for the state to respect a certain separation between the institutions of the state, particularly the executive and the judicial branch, and parliament. Parliament, for example, should not be subject to religious oversight or control by religious institutions who want to veto or undermine decisions that are made in a democratic parliament. So that type of discussion over the constitutional arrangement and the autonomy of parliament and the autonomy of the different branches of government is a more, I think, productive way of having a conversation than simply shouting out or standing up and saying, we need a secular constitution, we need a secular system, we need, so talking about the values that sort of could promote a just society, all things considered, is the better way to have a productive conversation. So I would, just to summarize, I would say it's best for Muslims, because of this very complicated history of secularism, where the playing field is not level, and it's deeply connected to the legacy of colonialism and imperialism. And also, secularism is deeply associated with authoritarian post-colonial rule. I mean, Bashar al-Assad, who's a mass murderer, still continues to refer to himself as a secularist, right? And so on. So I think that's the way that I would handle it. It would be to sort of try and avoid the term, because there really isn't one term, that really easily translates. And even in the West, as I've written, there are many different traditions of secularism. Mm-hmm. French secularism is very different than American secularism. Mm-hmm. So you have these different historical experiences that have to be, acknowledged. But for Muslims, I think it's much more productive to put that term aside and talk about core political and ethical values that are needed to create a just society.
All right. I have to call it at the end here, though there is so much interesting points to discuss and deliberate with you. I hope I get another chance with you to continue this conversation. But at this point, really grateful for your interest to this podcast, and enjoyed talking to you.
Great. Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation. Take care.